Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week from the United Kingdom, Lindsay German. She is the convener of the Stop the War Coalition, one of the best peace organizations I know about on either side of the Atlantic Ocean, and she has been at the counter summit and the protests of the big NATO summit in Wales. She is the author of numerous wonderful books. We'll have them all listed at talknationradio.org. Lindsay German, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David.
So what has been your experience in Wales with protesting NATO?
Well, we've been up in there for the past week, really, since last Saturday. There was a protest then, there was another one yesterday. There's been a peace camp all week, we've had the counter summit. So there have been thousands of people who've been taking part in the protest. And of course, what we've experienced is what everybody who tries to do this experiences, which is huge amounts of security, schools closed, roads closed, big steel barriers to stop people going anywhere near the summit so that they're completely cut off from any protest or any discussion even. It's a completely hermetically sealed thing. They had 10,000 police there. Somebody told me it cost £52 million just to protect these people for 3 days. We had our voices heard. We managed to get a delegation which went through the security barrier and handed in a series of letters to two government officials. So we'll wait and see whether anybody reads these or responds to them. But essentially, I think we had a good protest, and it was very important to be there when NATO is probably making some of its most important decisions for many, many years.
We had a huge protest when they were in Chicago some years back. I hope they are getting the impression that they aren't welcome anywhere. I actually saw a great video that Stop the War Coalition has already put together about the protests in Wales, in which you actually said that you thought we were in the most dangerous situation we've seen regarding wars since the end of World War II, and that NATO is a big part of that. Can you explain?
I think if you look at two very, very big areas, there's, of course, the whole question of the Middle East, where NATO's interventions and the NATO powers which have intervened, not always through NATO, but they've intervened directly in the bombing of Libya, the role of the US and Britain in particular in Iraq, the covert intervention in Syria. And so we've got a disastrous situation now in Syria and in Iraq with the growth of ISIS, with the country, Iraq, really broken up into three different parts, with some discussion about whether or not they're going to arm the Kurds, although some of the Kurds are people who are listed as terrorist organizations, both in the United States and in the European Union. So we've got that is one of them. The other, of course, is the situation in the Ukraine, where the expansion of NATO eastwards as part of the ongoing process of the expansion of the European Union eastwards, so that it incorporates many of the states which were formerly either in the Eastern Bloc or actually in the Soviet Union itself, has created a lot of tensions in the area, which we're seeing with the war in Ukraine. Now, hopefully there will be a ceasefire there, but basically the line that Rasmussen, the head of NATO, is taking is simply this, that everybody has to spend more money, that the Americans in particular are complaining that not enough countries in Europe are spending money on defense. They're saying that everybody has to increase their spending because of the supposed Russian threat, and they are trying to enlarge even further eastwards and to have what they call a rapid response force, which actually will be effectively the permanent sighting of troops, something which governments in the West gave Russia and the East European countries assurances that they wouldn't do only 20 years ago. But now we're seeing this happening. So I think we are seeing masses of fault lines here, and that's before you even look at Afghanistan, the whole situation in Africa, and, of course, the threats of war in the Far East with Japan and China and so on.
It seems like NATO, among other purposes, serves to sort of give these so-called leaders of its national members a step of removal from responsibility. I know that when the United States military claims that NATO did something in Afghanistan rather than the United States did it, Congress isn't allowed to investigate it. It doesn't have the power to oversee it in the same way. And NATO has really been pushing this idea of a Russian invasion of Ukraine, and it's NATO that has put out this sort of blurry satellite photo of supposed Russian artillery going into Ukraine. Are the national leaders that are there meeting as the constituents of NATO avoiding actually making claims and statements and taking responsibility for actions by doing it under the banner of NATO?
Well, that's a very interesting question because, of course, as you say, they then say, oh, this isn't our responsibility, although most of the European governments are now involved in some way in NATO. But, of course, it also has another effect, which is that NATO, particularly under its present leadership, is very keen to say, well, you know, nobody's really tough enough and we need to be much tougher. Obama is risk averse. I mean, you wouldn't think that in the last couple of weeks there's been more than 100 airstrikes on Iraq, a country that Britain and the United States were supposed to have withdrawn from some years ago. You wouldn't think that there's been an increase in these wars. They talk about it as if there are hardly any wars going on in the place, that Obama doesn't want them, and then there's in Britain they say, well, it was a missed opportunity that we didn't bomb Syria last year because that would have got rid of ISIS, whereas actually, almost certainly, the exact opposite is the case, that ISIS would have been strengthened by that bombing. But this is, so you've got this kind of narrative which is being put. You've got NATO saying, we've got to be tougher, we've got to do this. At the same time, it allows the nation states to sort of absolve some responsibility for their own actions and to say, well, we have to do this because we're part of this greater defense alliance. But if you look at what NATO is arguing, it's really quite warmongering stuff, and it really is quite dangerous stuff, and they're encouraged in this by a number of states, including a number of the East European states, who for historic reasons have many grievances with Russia and the former Soviet Union. That's understood, but that shouldn't be a justification for present and future wars.
I saw a video of the so-called leaders of all of these nations there at the summit with the what are the fancy British military airplanes, the red somethings?
The Red Devils were doing it. Yes, they did. Apparently, they did all these. We missed this when we were down there demonstrating, but they did all these somersaults and things for the benefit, as far as I can see, of the journalists who are there in their many, many hundreds covering this event. So,
well, but the journalists, the journalists put out a video of all the national leaders standing there on the runway, I think, at an airport, watching these planes fly over and make red, white, and blue smoke trails behind them, like a flag, and they looked so so excited and impressed, and I pictured them all in mass rushing for the bathroom afterwards. I mean, it gave the impression that these are people who are power mad and enthused with military weaponry and control of the world, as opposed to people making rational decisions and using force as a last resort and so forth.
I think that's right. I think if you actually look at what they're doing, you see, part of it, you think about these conferences, why do they need to have a summit? We've now got teleconferencing and all sorts of ways that people can talk to each other, if that's what they need to do, without travelling thousands of miles, without being put up at vast expense and with huge amounts of security. And, of course, partly they do it precisely to convince themselves that they're doing the right thing and precisely to psych up anybody who might have any rational thoughts that war isn't the answer, to psych them up to the idea that we can do this, we must do this. And we've seen this so much over recent years in particular. We saw it so much in 2001 with Afghanistan, in 2003 with Iraq, and again with Libya in 3 years ago, and then with Syria. And of course, Libya is a complete disaster. Nothing works in Libya, and the Britain had to send a Royal Navy ship to evacuate most of its citizens only a month ago. So none of this works, but nonetheless, they keep repeating the mantra that it is what works. And if you think about it, for example, if you take the question of the Ukraine, there are many options that you can have. The most beneficial, I would argue, for the people of the Ukraine is some kind of political settlement where if people have different interests in different parts of the country, then maybe you can have a federal state which actually guarantees language rights and deals with some of the other grievances that people have got. Nobody talks in these terms. They talk in terms of to go to war or not to go to war. This is the only option on the table. And of course, if people say, well, we don't want to go to war, you're either accused of being a supporter of Vladimir Putin, which I'm certainly not, and most people that I know in the anti-war movement certainly are not, or you're accused, as they try to do with any government that resists this whole agenda, that you're accused of being somehow wimpish, allowing terrorists to get away with these things and everything else.
We're speaking with Lindsay German, who is a convener of the Stop the War Coalition in the United Kingdom and has been at the NATO protests and counter-summit. Were there demands in the letter that was delivered and the statement from all of the organizations and people protesting? Were there demands that we might expect NATO to conceivably meet apart from its disbandment and abolition?
Well, we are, of course, in favor of its abolition, so that's one of the things we've been arguing for. But we've also been saying, okay, let's have a ceasefire in Ukraine. Let's look for a political solution in Iraq. Let's not spend any more money. In fact, let's spend less money on warfare and spend it on education and the kind of things people need. The place where the summit is taking place is a very poor city. It's a former steel and coal mining area. It's been depressed economically for many, many years. And really, if you think about the $52 million spent on security, what could that have done for the people of Newport? It could have done a huge amount. So we've said to NATO, we don't want them expanding, we don't want them spending more money on defence, we don't want any of these things. But unfortunately, I think all of us, if we're realistic about it, don't really believe they're going to stop doing these things without further protest.
And it seems like there's mixed news in terms of Ukraine, that there is some resistance in Europe to war in Ukraine beyond the protests at the NATO summit, and there's a possibility of a ceasefire. At the same time, the United States is now sending troops into Ukraine. NATO is talking about Ukraine and Georgia becoming members. NATO is talking about a force of soldiers to be stationed in Eastern Europe and NATO expansion into Finland and Sweden. Which direction are things moving now?
Well, this is the very, very big question, because as you know, historically, this is hugely important. The whole area of Ukraine during the Second World War was one where the Nazi occupation of the country and the invasion of the country as part of the invasion of Russia saw the most hideous pogroms of Jews and all sorts of other people, communist soldiers and all sorts of other people. And I think there's a very, very strong sense of history. And I think in Europe as a whole, there are enough people who know what the consequences of a European war would mean to make people think twice, which is why if you look at, for example, the role in Germany, there's much more criticism of what's going on in Ukraine and NATO's role in Ukraine from the German media and German society generally than perhaps there is in Britain, because Germany is been in the center of Europe and has suffered very, very badly as a consequence of the two world wars. So I don't think people want the war, but as you say, there are all sorts of pressures the other way. If Georgia and Ukraine become NATO members, in NATO's constitution, the if any country is attacked, then NATO is supposed to come to its aid. Now, you don't have to believe that they are going to be attacked. Maybe they could be, maybe they wouldn't be in the future. But as we've seen with the NATO claim that there is a supposed invasion by Russia, which clearly is not the case. I mean, there clearly are Russian troops in Ukraine, but it clearly hasn't been invaded in any serious sense of the word invasion. And there's far more American troops scattered around Syria, Jordan, and all across the Middle East than there are Russian troops in Ukraine. But, of course, once you start pulling these countries, which have long-standing hostility to Russia, into NATO, once you start putting troops on the ground, as there are, and there's going to be they won't put permanent troops, but they will have bases where effectively they rotate different troops. But so there is a permanent presence of NATO troops on the ground. There are all sorts of naval and air exercises going on this summer over the Baltic states, all these countries. And the governments of these countries, and we've had a whole stream of them on the radio and television over the last few days here in Britain, the governments of these countries, of course, are very, very keen on greater NATO involvement. And this tells you something about their whole political approach, that they grew up in opposition to the Soviet Union and to Russia, and they're very, very hostile to it. Now, these aren't the people who actually should make the decision about what NATO is doing, but that's what's happening. The new head of the European Council is a man called Donald Tusk, who's a former prime minister of Poland, who's a right-winger and who is very much anti-Russian. So we're talking about a political shift here, which has very serious implications. Maybe we can calm the thing down in Ukraine. And, of course, one of the reasons it may become calmed down is because it looks to me as though the rebels have gained a decisive advantage over the Ukrainian government troops. Maybe it can be calmed down in Ukraine, but the fear is that it will be recreated somewhere else in the not-too-distant future, in one of the Baltic states or somewhere else in Eastern Europe.
It's getting to be almost too many wars to keep track of.
I know. And you kind of think, all right, maybe, and I know you write a great deal and you have your program and everything. I know you write lots of different things, but you think to yourself, you get up in the morning, you think, okay, I'll write about Iraq, and then by the afternoon, there's some completely new question that you're writing about.
Oh, absolutely. You go to an anti-war protest and they've started a new war somewhere else by the time you get home. I wonder if Afghanistan is even on the agenda of the of those meeting at the summit or those protesting it. The longest war by some measures that the United States has ever been involved in, other than the slaughter of the Native Americans, and it's not ended. What's happening on that front?
Well, the summit, when it was originally planned, 9 months ago, the original plan of the summit, it would be about managing the withdrawal. It wasn't going to be a total withdrawal, but many of the troops being withdrawn from Afghanistan. Afghanistan this time has been a footnote, really, at the summit because of all these other issues that we've just been talking about. But, of course, any serious study of what's been going on in Afghanistan as well, an American general was killed there last month when supposedly in a safe British base. The Taliban have taken control of Sangin province, which is where most of the British soldiers who died in Afghanistan did die. So people must be asking. We've had, as you say, I mean, this has gone on longer than the First World War, longer than the Second World War, longer than both of them put together now. We were told there was victory back in the winter of 2001 because they overthrew the Taliban government. Well, that was only the beginning of the war. And now we have the situation in Afghanistan is worsening again. But worse than that, terrorism is now a feature across a whole number of countries. They're talking about they've raised the terror threat here in Britain because of people who've gone to fight in Syria, who they say will come back to Britain and carry out terrorist attacks. but they're not looking at what the root causes of these terrorist attacks are. And the root causes are the people that have these political grievances which haven't been resolved, and actually their grievances have been strengthened by the actions of the governments over the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere, and over the continuation of Guantanamo and all the other things that have been going on. So these are very, very big questions, which, of course, none of the governments really have an answer to.
When the war in Iraq started in 2003 and for the next decade, Stop the War Coalition and your allies in London and in Britain were some of the biggest opponents, the biggest rallies and protests and resistance. And now this is a war that's being renewed and a war in Syria that's being reversed. A year ago, we were supposed to bomb one side. Now we're supposed to bomb the other. There supposedly has been this side meeting at the NATO summit where they've put together a coalition of the willing to go back into this madness in a new way. How is that being received by the public in Britain?
Well, I think people are very, very worried about what is happening. And I think there was a poll this week which showed that half of the people asked are against any intervention again in Iraq. And I guess it would be pretty much the same, if not more, over Syria, just as it was last year. The problem is, what they're doing is that they show these terrible pictures of people being beheaded and the awful killing of these hostages. The next one in line looks like it's a British hostage, which, of course, they've known about for months. The British and American governments take the line that they won't pay any ransom because this will be helping the terrorists, whereas it's absolutely clear the terrorists, ISIS, are getting money. They're selling oil across the Turkish border. I mean, the question what money they get for a ransom of a British hostage is not their main source of income. That's the basic truth. They've taken all the weapons which the Iraqi army left behind in Mosul. And so the real question isn't whether they should, whether they need this money for the kidnapping. And I think it's quite outrageous, really, that our governments are saying they won't pay this money. The French and the Italians and so on have been paying hostage money. That's absolutely clear. And yet they're saying that these men can die and they don't really care what happens to them. But of course, this has an effect on public opinion because people see these things and they think, how barbaric, how terrible, and they're absolutely right to say that. They don't think necessarily about the barbarism which we have committed in these wars and occupations which we've been involved in. And there have been all sorts of killings which have been totally unjustified, all sorts of people who've died in horrible circumstances. And these things shouldn't be a pretext for war, but this is what they're trying to do. There's no question that's the way they're trying to take it.
And then the people cutting the throats know that it means more hellfire missiles, and the people sending the hellfire missiles know that it means more throat cutting. These things fuel each other. I think someone is going to have to break that cycle. And at this moment, it doesn't look like it's going to be NATO. I wanted to ask you, because it's also been in the news a little bit over here, what people in England think about Scotland potentially leaving Britain and what that means in terms of nuclear submarines in the United Kingdom and other weapons and militarism and NATO membership and so forth. Which side of Scotland independent yes or no are you on?
Well, personally, I'm in favor of a yes vote. I hope they do vote for independence. I mean, Scotland is a nation. It has the right to do so. There are many, many signs. If you go to Scotland, it's always been the case that Scotland is culturally and socially quite different from England in all sorts of ways. But in recent years, there's also developed a different political culture, a much more perhaps what you might call social democratic, much more left culture than the sort of neoliberalism that dominates in London and elsewhere in England. So I think they definitely have the right to do that. It raises huge questions about Trident, which is extremely unpopular in Scotland and for long has been very, very unpopular. And the Scots really do not want Trident. it's a very difficult problem for the British armed forces because they need deep water ports in order to maintain Trident. Of course, our argument is that we don't need Trident, that Trident is an extremely expensive, dangerous, and actually obsolete weapon system, which should be abolished. And certainly our friends in the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, who've campaigned over this for many years, have a campaign at the moment about that money should be spent on the health service and not on Trident. So I think Scotland, I think whatever happens in Scotland, it still looks, at the moment, the polls are still slightly, the majority will vote not to go independent, but nobody really knows. Nobody really knows. It's clear that among working class people, among the poorer people in Scotland, there's more support for yes, for going independent, than there is from the richer people who are much more heavily want to stay as part of a union with Britain. And whatever happens, I think now it will be a very close vote. If it is a yes vote, it raises all sorts of questions about the politics in Britain. It raises questions about Northern Ireland. It raises questions about Wales. It raises questions about what sort of government we want. Even if it's a no vote, the question is not going to go away because it will be a narrow victory for the no campaign. So we will see this resurfacing, and it is going to have a big impact, particularly if there's a yes vote, on the whole nature of politics in Britain. I think, although Cameron says he won't go even if there's a yes vote, in the papers today it says that there is a plot by Tory MPs to remove him if there is a yes vote. And I don't really see how he can survive if there is a yes vote, because he insisted on a question on the ballot paper which was about independence, whereas the nationalists in Scotland would have been happy with something that they called devolution max. In other words, much more devolution, much more local powers that they control, but not complete independence. So he pushed this thinking it would be very unpopular in Scotland, and it looks like this is yet more. This is domestic blowback as well as the foreign policy blowback that he keeps getting.
Well, and if whichever way the vote goes, if some of the news is about people's concerns around the Trident nuclear submarines and other militarism, that would be helpful.
It definitely is. It's a big question in Scotland, and people in Scotland are very. They don't like having it in their country anyway. And if it goes, there's talk about sending it to Plymouth, but there's not really many places that they can send it. So that raises many questions, and of course, no doubt at the NATO summit, there was a great deal of concern about the possibility of independence.
We've been speaking with Lindsay German, convener of the Stop the War Coalition in the United Kingdom, and we will have to have you back on the program and keep in touch as we move toward war or peace, hopefully the latter. Lindsay German, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. It's really good to talk to you, and best wishes to you and all your listeners.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.